Helpful.
So, I heard a while ago a talk by a monk, Ajahn Amaro, about the elephant in the room. I'm sure you've all heard the analogy of the elephant in the room. And he compared the elephant in the room to be the Dhamma. The elephant in the room, for those of you who haven't heard the saying, and I'm sure almost everybody has, but for those of you who are unfamiliar or not sure what it means, it's basically that issue or that topic or that event that people don't talk about when they get together. Very often people in families or in jobs or in relationships, when they're together, they make a sort of unspoken agreement that there are certain topics or events from the past or issues that are just too uncomfortable or unpleasant or potentially disruptive to discuss. And so there's this unwritten contract that people make not to talk about the elephant in the room. And sometimes the elephant in the room can be so large and obvious, you wonder how people cannot address it. And yet, people can really avoid talking about some extraordinary things. I, for example, grew up in an alcoholic family, and we sort of had for a very long time, until we finally went into family therapy many, many, many years ago, we had an agreement never to discuss my dad's violent alcoholism, or my drug addiction was off the table too. So at different times I would show up to the dinner table with a busted, you know, blackened eye, and nobody would say anything. My mom would come to the table in rough shape and nobody would say anything. My dad would stumble to the table and nobody would mention anything. It was an unspoken agreement that if we did talk about it, it would be so potentially disruptive that we were better off just sweeping it under the table, even though it was so patently obvious that something was amiss. So that's the elephant in the room. I'm sure that you all can think of times in your life when you've made an unspoken pact with your family or roommates or friends not to talk about something. The idea is that the philosophy behind it is that there are things that we can bury that will just go away so long as we don't talk about them or look at them or acknowledge them. That somehow if we don't acknowledge something is there, even though anybody else would notice it, and even though it's having an effect, that somehow we are controlling it. This topic, this issue that we're not addressing, that somehow by not acknowledging it, we're making things better than it would be if we did talk openly about this issue. So the underlying philosophy is actually one that goes back to our childhood. We all develop coping strategies from when we're very, very young. Many of the coping strategies we develop when we're young work when we're children because people indulge us when we're children. But they don't work when we become adults. For example, a child, when it wants to eat or get a present, will stomp, demand and say over and over and over again, I want candy or a cookie or I want this or that. And eventually, very often, the parents will cave in. And so that child is taught the lesson that if it just perseveres long enough with throwing a tantrum or a fit or making endless demands, that its desires will be met. Unfortunately, some people bring this tendency into their adult life. And when they don't get what they want from life, when life gives us the inevitable curves, when, as the Buddha said, we don't get what we want, or we get what we don't want, or when we're frustrated, or when we're our desires haven't been met, we, for example, might throw a tantrum. And then, rather than working like it did in childhood, our friends might say, what the fuck are you doing? Or they might abandon us. And then we get all confused. And we look for new friends who will acknowledge us when we throw our tantrums. Until eventually, this coping strategy we see doesn't work. But generally, that can process of letting go of a coping strategy can take years. In the case of alcoholism and drug abuse, it can take decades. The tendency to want to numb ourselves rather than face life's difficulties and discomforts can be a process that we tried for years and years and years in different ways until we finally realize it doesn't work. Such is the case with avoidance, not looking at things or acknowledging things. It can be a strategy that people practice for their entire lives. And it can cause great damage to relationships. It can cause untold discomfort in families when we don't acknowledge things that have caused us stress and suffering, events that we've done that have not been acknowledged. When people don't forgive or apologize or acknowledge their mistakes, we can, rather than trust them again, we make an unspoken agreement with ourselves never to trust that person, but we don't confront them. Now, these elephants in the room not only have to be with another person, often they can be just with ourselves. We can have an event in our past that we, when we think about it, we shudder. We become uncomfortable. Ooh, I don't like thinking about that. And when the subject comes up in our brain, we immediately make an agreement with ourselves not to look at it. So, I'm not trying to give the impression that the Buddha's Dharma is one of acknowledging everything willy-nilly. That's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha said sometimes it is strategically advantageous to have certain things that we don't always acknowledge. In fact, in the Sabbasava Sutta, the Buddha said that we should avoid certain things. We should avoid people that always cause us suffering and stress, that are unskillful people. We should avoid dangerous animals. He listed cliffs and pits as things we should avoid. I have no issue with that whatsoever. He also said that there are certain things that the mind tends to focus on that don't bring it any insight or wisdom or happiness that we can focus on obsessively. Sometimes we can focus obsessively on the way we look or certain things in the places that we live or other external things and become fixated on them and hoping that somehow if we change these things, change our appearance, whatever, we'll find lasting happiness. And this really doesn't work. So this kind of fixation with staring at externals or things that cause stress all the time, that's not a very skillful approach either. So the Buddha wanted us to acknowledge things when the results would be skillful, when the results would be good. So I'm going to tell you what kinds of things he wanted us to acknowledge, what kind of elephants in the room he wanted us to begin to work with. The first is we can use the foundation of right speech, which is asking ourselves before we acknowledge something that's uncomfortable, asking ourselves, do we know that it's true? Do we know that it's useful looking at this thing? And do we know that it's the right time? For example, very often in therapy, we might have a breakthrough where we might realize, say, that a parent has abandoned us, a mother or a father didn't meet our needs. And in that therapy, we can become fixated with the idea, I was abandoned, I wasn't loved, I was mistreated as a child, etc. And when we have that first recognition, there's nothing wrong with it. But occasionally we become so fixated on the story rather than the feelings underneath the story that nothing comes of it. A good therapist, when we realize that we've not looked at feelings of abandonment, will not let us stay in the story over and over and over again, mommy didn't love me, daddy didn't love me. They'll say, let's go to the feelings. What are you feeling right now about that? Rather than just simply stay in that story. So it's the story that's not necessary, but more the feelings that are necessary that we become aware of and acknowledge. Another good example of something that's not helpful is it is quite true that billions of years from now, the sun will supernova. And everything that you know that is here right now will, well, by then probably it will all be gone anyway, but the earth will be vaporized, etc. Hollywood loves to make these stories, by the way. I've seen New York destroyed in at least half the movies I've seen of late. But I'm not 100% sure that walking around with the idea, oh, all of this is going to be laid to waste eventually by a supernova, is the most skillful or helpful thought that we can have in our minds. It's true, but it's not particularly useful. Much as the thought, I was abandoned by my parents, carrying around this thought or this story, or I'm a victim, people have mistreated me, carrying around this story all the time is not particularly helpful. It tends to be something that we use to excuse ourselves for any action that we take, for our bad behavior. It doesn't allow us to grow. It becomes this prison that we live within, this I'm a victim, I can do whatever I want because I've been mistreated in my life. So it's not a particularly skillful or helpful story to carry around. Another issue is, are we ready to look at certain issues? There are times in life when we are not yet ready to face certain important facts. For example, the Buddha said that he taught something called anatta, or no self, or not self, actually, that there's no final identity to who we are. But the Buddha never anticipated that people would practice this notion early on in their spiritual growth. It was something that we were supposed to look at very later on, much later on in our spiritual practice. He never taught the beginning monks or the beginning students about not self. In fact, he taught them about developing a very positive sense of self. And then when the time came that they were ready to let go of self, then he told them, well, in fact, there is no lasting identity to who you are. You do exist, but you don't have any final lasting identity. It's who you are is changing. So this teaching is a very advanced teaching, and it's not something that we should try to get our heads around too early in our spiritual practice. So there's another idea of what we should only acknowledge when the time is right. Other times, for example, when we're young and we're out of school, we can, just to get a job, wind up doing a job that later on in life we would shudder at the very thought of doing. I know I had my fair share of them. But sometimes it's just a good, skillful idea to get the practice of working for a little while and then finding a job that is more suitable to our goals in life. But sometimes we just have to first get the practice underfoot before we realize that what we're doing isn't appropriate for us. So these are the three main issues to ask before we undertake just running into our family living room and confronting our parents with all the unspoken, unacknowledged events of the past. Is it true? Is it something that we've actually experienced and know to be true? Is it useful? And is this the right time? So what did the Buddha, though, want us to acknowledge at all times? The Buddha said there's one thing we should acknowledge no matter what, and that is underlying physical and emotional stress and suffering. That's called mindfulness. Keeping an awareness on your body, on your gut feelings, and knowing when you are getting stressed out, when you are becoming physically uncomfortable, when something is emotionally becoming stressful. And first, seeing if we can, once we acknowledge this, seeing if we can simply work with it to relax it, to spare ourselves this level of stress and suffering that's going on unconsciously just beneath the level of our awareness. Now, this practice can be extremely, extremely powerful. I've seen in my own experience, people who come into 12-step meetings, and they're in their first or their second meeting, and they raise their hand and they share, and the moment they acknowledge that they've been unhappy in their lives and suffering, they break out crying. Because for so many years, they haven't acknowledged how unhappy they are. I've seen people who are in unhappy marriages and relationships break down crying when they acknowledge how unhappy they are. Likewise, when they're in jobs that are, over the years, causing them to feel miserable. Just the process of acknowledging, I'm unhappy, there's stress, I'm physically uncomfortable, and I haven't allowed myself to look at this, can be an extremely powerful life-altering practice. It takes us away from the thoughts that we cover up all this underlying stress and discomfort to keep ourselves in bad situations. People can be in terrible, abusive relationships, not acknowledging that they are uncomfortable and miserable because their brain says, I've got to be in a relationship, I'm getting older, I'll never find another woman or another man or another partner. I can't be alone. So they stay in relationships where there's abuse going on or where they're being controlled or manipulated or unloved because they don't feel that they can look at this underlying suffering and discomfort. So it's very important to be aware of what's really going on. The truth is not so much what we're thinking at any point. The truth is what's going on beneath the level of thought, what's going on in the body. Is the body physically uncomfortable? Is the stomach tight? Is the shoulders going up to the ears? Are we physically, and is our gut feelings being contorted to the point that our very underlying life is always uncomfortable, that from the moment we wake up till we fall asleep, there's a level of stress going on that we're simply not acknowledging. This can be the most powerful elephant in the room, the fact that we're not acknowledging our own stress and suffering. This is why the Buddha made seeing suffering the first noble truth, because so many of us don't even see it, don't even know what areas of our lives are causing us stress and suffering. We so talk ourselves into, well, I've got to be in this job, I've got to be in this relationship, I've got to be in this family, I can't say anything to my father, I can't say anything to my husband, I can't say anything to my wife, I can't say anything to my boss, whatever, that we keep ourselves locked away from our bodies, unaware of what's going on. The second thing is, once we become aware of that there's stress and suffering going on, doing what we can do, of course, to alleviate that. A lot of the times, the stress and suffering we're feeling is caused by our own actions, our own intentions, our own expectations that people will be different than we know them to be. One of the best wise things I've ever heard, I once heard somebody say, when you meet someone you're going to date, assume that they will never, ever, 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 ever change. You'll save yourself a lot of stress and suffering. But a lot of the times we meet people and we're like, oh, I really like them. It's just that one 25% of the things that they do that really irritate the shit out of me. But over the course of 30 years of marriage, I will push them and poke them and prod them until they behave in the way I want. I want them to. Of course they won't. And this level of expectation that they'll change in the way I want them to causes this underlying anxiety and frustration that we then don't acknowledge. And we keep ourselves in this constant push and pull rather than acknowledging and letting go of this agenda and seeing the other person that we're with for who they really are. A lot of times, too, though, the stress and the suffering is caused by a situation we're in. And the Buddha was never, ever shy in telling people to get out of abusive situations. Abusive sanghas, abusive, if you're, God forbid, an abusive sangha. Abusive, you know, abusive jobs, abusive families, whatever. So it's important to acknowledge, to see what we are doing that's causing the stress and suffering, see what we can work with to acknowledge it and address it. These are two of the most profound practices. They go to the very heart of the Buddha's teachings. Acknowledging that we're stressed out, seeing what we're doing that is causing the stress and suffering, the expectations, the anticipations, the never allowing our minds to be present, the living constantly in the future, the running away and not looking at certain things from our past. Finally, the Buddha emphasized the last part of this practice as possibly the most important, is acknowledging to ourselves and others when we've made mistakes. This is when the Buddha's teaching actually on not self is the most helpful, because the Buddha never said that when we acknowledge that we've made a mistake that we should beat ourselves up or say, oh, I'm a terrible person. In the past, I did this thing, I made this mistake, I got into this relationship that was wrong for me, I got into this job that's a mistake, what an idiot I am. This tendency to beat ourselves up or to, when we've done something damaging, to conclude that we're a terrible person is what keeps us from acknowledging when we simply made an action that we don't want to do again, when we've authored an action that causes stress and suffering. If we let go of this tendency to globalize when we've made a mistake and say, that defines entirely who I am, because I've once in my life lied or cheated or stolen or whatever, that makes me a terrible person, that gives us the permission to acknowledge to the people who are affected and especially to ourselves, hey, I made a mistake. I did something. It's causing me stress and suffering. I don't want to do that action again. That's the final part of the puzzle of acknowledging the elephant in the room, seeing that it's there, seeing what we're doing that's causing it to be there, and then resolving not to do whatever it is again if we're the ones who've authored it, so that we don't have to continually live with these unacknowledged events in our lives. So, I hope that's of some interest to you tonight. That's my talk on acknowledging the unavoidable, the elephant in the room. And I hope that you'll now share with us any thoughts you have on this subject or anything that's going on in your spiritual practice. Thanks for listening.